Welcome to the final episode of Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter. Thanks for joining us on this long, strange trip into the history of my family, past, and subculture. In the previous episode, my dad confessed a secret to my mom he'd been holding for almost 30 years. In 1992, my senior year of high school, and 4 years after my mom thought dad had retired from outlaw life, my dad and his New York smuggling partner, Hi-Fi, loaded up a car with a rinky-dink smuggle of 50 pounds of poor-quality pot in the Midwest. Soon after, Hi-Fi was busted, and his freedom ended up costing Hi-Fi 10 years of debt to the Mexican cartel. Dad got out of pot smuggling a free man by the skin of his teeth. Despite his arrest, Hi-Fi, a man of honor, never rolled on my parents. In this episode, my parents speak to Hi-Fi for the first time since 1992. I'm Rainbow Valentine. This is Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter.
Rolling a doobie, young, free, and groovy, making it up as we roll along.
Great childhood because I had wonderful, invested, supportive, loving parents, a stable home and family, and the immense privilege of wealth, which provided education, opportunity, and freedom. I was a lucky child because my parents were careful, industrious, and creative, along with their adrenaline-loving risk-taking. Being blissfully unaware my parents were pot smugglers, I never felt burdened the way other children of smugglers privy to their parents' illicit activities may have felt. My big sister, Vertica, didn't want to speak on tape for fear of hurting our parents' feelings. Because for her, growing up aware our parents were smugglers was difficult. Now, this podcast has prompted most of my childhood friends to reveal they too are smugglers' kids or smuggler adjacent. And one of my oldest best friends, we'll call Saffron, is a smuggler's daughter who was aware of her mom's unlawful occupation, like my older sister. Last time I was in California, I sat down with Saffron, and although I've known Saffron for 40 years, I'd never heard these stories.
Okay, so I want to talk about you growing up with smuggler parents and knowing, having the knowledge as a child that your parents were involved in this trade, which was not my experience, but it was the experience of my sister. So I just want to, you know, tell me about that. Tell me about...
So I did know, I knew two things. I knew that both of my parents did drugs because they did them, I mean, like, in front of me, so it was not, there was nothing hidden in my world at all, nothing at all. I guess I was aware of the smuggling. I was aware of the smuggling, because I remember having kind of an underlying sense of fear all the time. I remember I got a note sent home to my biological father, and it was spelled the wrong way. And the way they spelled it was the name of a federal agency. And so I freaked out because I thought that it was about that agency and that they were after us.
So you thought a federal agency was sending a note home? Correct.
I was like in first grade or
right.
something at that point. Yeah.
Running.
But yeah, so I remember sort of a constant underlying sense of fear or dread or concern, you know, like knowing that something was not right, and knowing that like at a legal level, but then also knowing it at a the functionality of my parents' level, like they were inebriated a lot of the time, and so that created challenges, and also knowing it at a very practical level, like when I would bring a friend over, I would have to make them wait at the door so I could run up and put away all the drugs that were upstairs in our house. And I was always afraid that a friend would see the drugs. It was only later that I learned, in fact, it was only really recently that I learned that so many of my friends' parents were doing drugs, and I had no idea.
Yeah, you described to me sitting on bales of pot.
Yeah, when I was really little, four maybe, our house didn't have very much furniture, but there were bales of pot that were like our seats and our table. Yeah, and that was, to me, that was normal. Yeah. Like, I didn't really have any judgment about the stuff itself, except that I knew societally it was bad. And I knew that I got really annoyed when my parents were stoned. And I would call them stoned old people because they would make me crazy because they were stupid, as I perceived it.
While Saffron and I both come from psychedelic pioneers, a lot of her experiences were shaped, unlike me, by parents with addiction. For many years, her mom was an addict, and her biological father was mentally unstable. And her parents were into cocaine as well as pot. So Saffron's childhood is sprinkled with more danger and risk than mine. Her mom regularly took her to the interior Amazon jungle, where her biological father lived. And being a single parent, her mom would now and again take Saffron to work with her, meaning go do deals. Saffron remembers accompanying her mom to various Marin homes, sitting in a corner and reading books about horses, while her mom and colleagues would conduct business, a.k.a. drug deals.
How long did your mom smuggle for? How long did you know? Was this your whole childhood?
So I guess, I don't know if this is a specious distinction, but I actually make a distinction between smuggling and dealing.
Yeah, they're totally different. My dad was never a dealer.
Yeah, so my mother was a dealer most of my life. I think she only smuggled for a little while when I was really young and when we were going back and forth from South America.
So Saffron's mom was a dealer, which means she was selling much smaller quantities than my dad, a distributor, who was selling quantities in the thousands of pounds. Saffron's mom was probably working in the 20 pounds to 100 pounds. Saffron's mom also dealt cocaine in addition to pot, whereas my dad only distributed pot, except for that one time in 1972 with a Rose Coke. Saffron and I started talking about money.
Because I didn't really put money together with pot as a kid.
Oh.
They were separate.
No, I do. I knew money was associated with drugs because I remember this one time that my mother had done a particularly large deal and she was talking to me about what we should do with the money.
Oh my God.
I was somewhere between 8 and 12. I always felt like we had enough. It didn't feel like we didn't. I didn't feel like we were rich. And part of it was also that she was a single mom. Mm-hmm. So it was, there was a bit of struggle in there, but nothing, not real struggle. You know, we had a house and all of that.
I asked what happened with her biological father. We hadn't talked about it much growing up.
So what would happen was my biological father, she'd send me down there to live with him and with a round trip ticket. And then he would...
On the plane by yourself?
Mm-hmm. Have I not shown you those photos? I have amazing photos of me, like, with Shipibo Amazonian spears on the airplane. Yes.
How old were you?
I think in that, I was, like, 6.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but she would send me down. I went down a couple times. I don't remember how many, but I remember at least once, and I think more than that, my father sold the plane ticket, probably for drugs.
And he sold your plane ticket at home?
So, yes, so she had to come down and, I mean, essentially he kidnapped me, sort of, depending on how you look at it. And so she would have to come down and get me. So, you know, they were both, like, super coked up. I remember, I have this very vivid memory of she came down to get me, and we were, I don't remember where we were, but we were in a hotel room, and it was very white, and they got in a fight, and he threw a hairbrush at her, and it hit her nose. And because she was so coked up, the blood just splattered everywhere. That was horrible. That was definitely not a good memory. But anyway, so she would come and take me home, and then we moved from Mill Valley out way out to West Marin, and my biological father was arrested for dealing or something in Peru and went to a Peruvian jail when I was 8. Then he and I would write letters to each other then.
How long was he in?
Well, he had such a crazy story. So he went to jail, and then somehow he managed to get married in jail to the woman that he'd been arrested with. And then because of that, they sent him off to live in the middle of the jungle, like weeks from nowhere. So he was out of jail, but he was in the middle of nowhere with this woman. And then on a finca, which is, means a farm, and then they managed to escape from there somehow, and they got up to Mexico. And then that was when I was 16, and I went down to visit my father, thinking that his wife would be there, and so he would be somewhat sane, but I was very wrong. I got there, and his wife had just left him 2 weeks before, and he was a total lunatic, but he wasn't dealing drugs at that point. But yeah, so that was a very real consequence of the drugs. There were no consequences ever with my mother, because she was never caught.
Today, Saffron has a much better understanding of her mom and a lot of respect for her. She admires her mom's ability to survive as a single mom and eventually get sober. Because ultimately, Saffron understands her mom did the best she could at the moment. And everyone is making it up as they roll along.
In my case, with my mother, I always knew, no matter what, that she loved me. Like, that was never a question for me. But she was crazy. I mean, that's sort of how I saw it, is she was crazy. And as I've gotten older, I've come to see it as she was doing the best she could. She was trying to provide, and she's sort of naturally the opposite of risk averse, risk compelled.
Yes, my parents too, adrenaline junkie.
Yeah, so there was something about that that she liked. And I also think she liked being a woman in a sort of largely male dominated world. And it was also a big sort of FU to the societal norms. It was, you know, I'm not good. Because she had a pretty pretty impressive academic, you know, pedigree, and she was super smart, and she could have done a lot of things, but she didn't want to do those things. It was part of the counterculture.
Saffron recently told me she always envied my family life because it appeared unchaotic compared to hers. Of course, she didn't know my dad was a smuggler like her mom, so to her, my parents appeared to be law-abiding and normal. Saffron points out that I enjoyed the best parts of being a smuggler's daughter, a childhood of great abundance and free of adult worries. Now, like several of my hippie kid friends, Saffron experienced psychedelics in childhood. And while she looks back at those events with some distress, she also believes taking psychedelics in childhood had benefits, revealing to her at an early age the comforting, harmonic unity of humans and nature.
Oh, I think I was talking to my mother about, like, the first time that I did mushrooms. And she said, well, actually. And I said, yeah. And she said, actually, the first time you did mushrooms, you were about 2.
What the fuck?
And I said, really? And she said, yeah, they were living on a commune in South America. And they had just cooked up, first of all, I don't even understand, like, why you would have mushrooms this way, but they had cooked up a magic mushroom omelet. And I had toddled into the kitchen, and I just ate the entire thing.
No!
Mm-hmm.
You ate the entire omelet?
That's what she says. And so I said, what happened? Like, what do you do? And she said that she took me down to the river and just held me for like 4 hours. And I just kind of stared at the water. And she said I was fine. She said I was happy. It was all okay. And then my biological father also wanted me to be part of the experience. And so when I was like 4 and 5, I participated in several ayahuasca ceremonies. Do you not know this?
I knew you were given psychedelics as a child, but I don't know the details.
Yeah, yeah. So I
didn't know it was ayahuasca. I thought it was acid.
No, I don't. don't think I took acid when I was a little child. That's quite a statement to make.
But it's also like, it was such a normal statement you just said. Like, it didn't faze me. I didn't notice it as weird.
But I, you know, at some level, just last year I was talking to a fellow mom about this, and I realized that I think that maybe the combination of the mushrooms and the ayahuasca, like, it's always been just fundamentally clear to me that everything is connected, that all humans are connected, that we're connected to nature. That's never been, like, I never had a revelation about that. That was just the way it is. And it has occurred to me that maybe those early psychedelic experiences, like, because that's what people say psychedelic experiences do, right? They open your mind.
Connect you to nature, along with the street.
Yeah, and they open your mind to that. And so the kind of, while I spent a lot of my young adulthood, my teens and young adulthood, being, you know, fairly pissed off about the neglect, what I considered to be the neglect, and I am not advocating this as a parenting philosophy, and have not exposed my children to psychedelics, but you're right. But I do, part of me thinks that maybe that having those early psychedelic experiences contributed to that understanding, is my only point.
So you took ayahuasca as a 4- and 5-year-old?
I did.
Do you remember this?
I do. Yes, I do. So particularly, so the you know, we would all lie around in the brujo, who's the leader of it, in his hut, basically. And one time I usually got a kiddie's gourd, which was... I swear to God.
Oh, God. That's so fucking ridiculous. A kiddie's gourd? Were there other children?
No, it's just me.
And they called it the kiddie's gourd?
That's what I remembered as.
Like,
yeah. Yeah. But one time I drank from the grown-up's gourd. And what I remember of it was that my father found me far away from the hut. I had wandered away. And what I told him was that I was in a bombed out building in Dresden. In Dresden, mind you.
Yeah, you said that word?
Yeah. Yeah. And that I was next, but wait, it gets even weirder. I was next to a surgical operating table, but it was all okay because Frosty the Snowman was with me.
Whoa.
Yeah, isn't that trippy?
My hippie childhood home life was suburban compared to Saffron's cinematic psychedelic adventures, affirming my parents' dedication to stability, routine, and remaining invisible in order to successfully conduct business. Saffron's stories remind me how valuable it was to be unaware of my parents' illegal activities, and how valuable their sobriety was. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime. We'll be right back. After Reagan's anti-drug abuse act laws of 86 and 88, the Three Strikes You're Out law was passed in Washington State in 1993, followed by California in 1994. The Three Strikes Law significantly increases prison sentences of people convicted of a felony who've been previously convicted of two or more violent crimes or felonies, and limits the ability of these offenders to receive a punishment other than a life sentence. Now, possessing marijuana is still a felony, although it's gradually being decriminalized state by state, city by city. There are a huge number of people in prison for life because their third strike felony was possessing pot. Here's our cannabis lawyer, Bill Panzer, telling me about three strikes and its ramifications.
So, what happened? What was the consequence of the three strikes law in California?
Well, I mean, it's, among other things, you know, for other reasons too, it was filling up the prisons. Of course, you know, it gets applied unequally. I mean, if you look at percentage of non-white people to white people in the general population, and then you look at percentage in the prison population, they ain't the same.
Right.
You know, if you have, you know, color is critical here, but the color that's critical is not white or black. The color that's critical is green.
Money.
And if you've got the money to afford representation and afford a good lawyer and all that, you're bound to do a lot better. Now, because of various socioeconomic, you know, factors in the last 200 years in this country, there's a strong correlation between people with money and white people, and people without money and people of color.
Today, while it's still federally a Schedule I drug and possessing it a felony, 11 states have decriminalized cannabis. However, unfortunately, legalization has come with big corporations and big money crushing small family farms, destroying the economics of small towns reliant on the pot industry, including much of Northern California. Today, many towns in California's Mendocino and Humboldt counties, once thriving with pot prosperity of the black market, are struggling with joblessness and poverty, manifesting in empty storefronts throughout the Emerald Triangle, the region's nickname. So obviously, cannabis is part of the fabric of Northern California, which brings me back to my pot-smuggling parents. So after my dad quit smuggling, the 90s were tough financially, and it took a mental toll. But fortuitously, Marin County real estate appreciated, and my parents were able to live off their only asset, our Mill Valley home, until my dad successfully built his own legal business in sales. The Mill Valley house and its continuously growing value was like a bank account for many years, until the economy crashed in 2008, when my parents lost it. But their positive outlook and critical thinking skills enabled them to move forward without regret. Mill Valley and Marin County have changed from homespun hippie hamlets to uber-wealthy enclaves of investment bankers and techies, displacing my family, along with many psychedelic pioneers who moved further north to Sonoma, Mendocino, and Humboldt counties, and the Pacific Northwest. In the 30 years since my dad quit smuggling, he's lost and rebuilt everything at least three times. Because even though he quit smuggling, he never lost his love of the adrenaline rush from financial risk-taking. For years, Dad, accustomed to playing with money like Monopoly, couldn't resist investing in various smooth-talking scam artists and doomed entrepreneurs. In the early 2000s, my parents finally got married to each other, became grandparents, and reinvented themselves in hospitality. Today, they're in their 70s and once again emerging from total economic loss and starting a new business. They are tenacious, industrious, visionary Humpty Dumpties with absurd senses of humor, and in the darkest days, their cup remains half full. I'm at their house in Northern California, and it's shortly after my dad revealed to my mom that his smuggling partner Hi-Fi had been busted in 1992, a secret Dad buried for almost 30 years. So Dad's confession propelled my parents to call Hi-Fi to make amends. And incredibly, I got to be a fly on the wall for the singular moment. This is the first time they've spoken in 27 years. Not realizing my parents had begun the call with Hi-Fi, I started recording midway through their conversation after Hi-Fi's initial surprise at hearing from my dad had passed. You might hear a buzz as technology, like people, is imperfect.
We just got through talking about you and my whatevers.
Ohio.
And so,
Ohio.
Oh, fuck.
I'm so sorry. It's just like wrecked your life. We couldn't help you. I mean, it was just crazy.
Yeah, I couldn't tell her. I was too embarrassed and whatever. It's no excuse. I don't have any excuse for it other than I didn't tell her until just now. And it's kind of a good thing.
You feel a lot lighter, do you?
Well,
do you?
Listen.
He does.
Fucked up big time. That doesn't give you back your life.
No, it doesn't. And it never will. You know, that's it. that's gone. You know, it was and would, you know, will never be.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
I don't know how you got through that.
Well, it was a challenge.
Oh.
It kind of snowballed, and that is only one facet of.
Oh no.
Of my
downward slide.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing led to another, and it kind of, you know, there was the immediate problem, but there were other things that manifested.
Oh, how horrible!
It's like I said, you know, it's history, you know, it's.
Yeah, it is history, but it's lives and years.
Well, you can't change the lives and years, but we can be in the present and move forward.
Yeah, and that's what we've done, haven't we? And, you know, and we took, you know, we kind of, you know, found each other again, you know, so that's a positive thing. And,
yeah.
And, you know, who knows the future? I don't have a crystal ball. I wish I did, you know, because, you know, if I did, I wouldn't be where I was. Well, I might be, but.
You know, I mean, I didn't know these guys. I vaguely knew them. It was.
So you threw me to the wolves?
No, man. Threw you to the wolves.
Thank you for not throwing us to the wolves.
Oh.
Thank you.
I still have very few words because I have so little to say. Well, I can say I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, that's kind of a, well, thank you.
It doesn't mean much at all.
Oh, it kind of does.
Well, you know me, and I don't believe I'm especially frivolous with my feelings. And the bullshit, you know, I mean, fuck, we're sort of, we've grown a little older, and...
You have.
He's found the fountain of youth. Did you find God, too?
I'm working on it.
Better late than never, as they say. My parents' call with Hi-Fi was a start to mending their broken bridge, and I was struck by my mom thanking Hi-Fi for not turning my parents to the wolves, as she said. Reconciliation is complicated, but I took the fact that Hi-Fi and my dad were ribbing each other to be a good sign, as well as the laughter from everyone. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime. We'll be right back. So I started this podcast after seeing billboards for weed delivery apps all over California. And concerned the pot-smoking kids in weed-legal states were unaware of the extreme risks undertaken by the pot smugglers of yore, I embarked on this project to illuminate cannabis's rocky path towards legality. History is important, and as America moves towards national cannabis legalization, pot smuggler stories are archival prohibition tales, which must be preserved and told, so we don't repeat patterns of behavior based on racism and hate. Remember, reefer madness propaganda started because alcohol prohibition ended and a government official, Harry Anslinger, wanted to preserve his power, hence the frenzy of anti-cannabis hype for a largely harmless drug primarily used by Mexicans and African Americans, and then beatniks and artists, leading to the counterculture. Harry Anslinger's professional ambition and bigotry led to the Reagan's egregious anti-drug laws of the 1980s that destroyed and continue to destroy people's lives. And the thing is, so many people throughout history and today believe pot is good. It's a powerful, non-addictive plant with positive benefits for many people. Of course, not every human has the same physiology. So not everyone has the same reaction to smoking cannabis. But current medical science is proving that cannabis has medical properties, including anxiety and inflammation reduction, pain management, and inducing the giggles. After all, laughter is the best medicine. I called my parents one last time to record. They've gotten a lot better at it since we started recording about a year ago.
Is it recording?
Yeah. It looks like it. The little red lines are moving.
Yes, it's okay. Recording.
Well, what do you guys want to say? Anything you want to say? And here we are in the final episode conclusion.
You go first.
I've been holding in an important and formative part of our family's life for 30 plus years. And I had no idea how cathartically freeing speaking about it and listening to other of my friends, what it's done for me. I think for Taffy can speak for herself, but it's just our lives, you know, which that's how we live. We're very fortunate on so many levels, especially after listening to the stories I've heard from other of my friends, some of whom I had absolutely no idea about what the hell parts of their lives were going on.
Mom?
Yeah. Yeah. Excuse me. The truth will set you free.
Or lock you up.
Yeah, or lock you up. But if I had it to do over again, because I'm a real 60s idealist, I could see no reason for weed to be criminalized and taking joy away from the people. The populace has enough problems and suffering, and if you could relieve suffering and make people laugh, I thought it was like your highest calling.
What are your theories on why you guys never got caught?
Why do we think we didn't get popped ever?
Yeah.
Because I mean, I'm fairly clear about, because it was the way I did business. I was very stringent about who I hung out with, that I had, I did most all of my own driving locally. Mm. The less moving parts, the less people, the less potential for somebody getting in trouble for who knows what. Doing who knows what to whom, so I was really very cautious about that, and just consequently, I didn't have a lot of people working for me, and I wasn't so greedy as to do something that foolish. Only greedy enough to do something as foolish as losing my money several times. But we're still here, and I feel quite rich now. You know, full. Rich is a level of something.
Yeah. Mom, do you have any?
Yeah, I like the idea of fulsomeness, you know, from having led an interesting life. And striving to create some truth, and I think that we were, two heads are better than one sometimes, and when there's all these bozos around there doing like weird things and not being prepared, I think we were super prepared because we were so paranoid, you know. So what's great about now is that we're trying to lift the paranoia from a lifetime of paranoia and change our behavioral patterns, you know. So that's interesting too.
Yeah, that is interesting. You mean by revealing your stories.
Well, yeah, by being able to, like, be on the phone and talk about weed now, that is, like, something, like, you know, to overcome, like, for 35 years or 50 years or whatever, like, you've been afraid to talk on the phone because the phone would be tapped or people or surveillance. And, like, you know, there's a point when you just, like, you got to stop worrying about it because it is... It doesn't exist. It's a structure that it was like completely paralyzing structure. We didn't take chances like being hung out there to dry. Usually, like 90% of the time.
Except when we did, yeah. Of course.
Except when hi-fi, like, you know, like that would have been a... That was a disaster, you know, like, but any upstanding, like, drug dealer would have lots of lawyers.
Well, and lots of luck.
Lots of luck. And God loves,
drug dealers, good pot dealers.
Artists. God loves artists and people that take risks. So I think that even though I don't believe in God, that God was there.
That is ridiculous.
Well, yes, that's us. Here, that's us. Ridiculous is us. I mean, you know, I mean.
Praise the Lord and pass the potatoes.
As I considered what to say in the final episode, I read this quote by Polish poet, writer, and translator, Czesław Miłosz. Sorry if I said his name wrong. Winner of the 1980 Nobel Prize in Literature. He wrote, "When a writer is born into a family, that family is finished." Thank you, family, for supporting my writing about you. Because now I know myself so much better. And may our story inspire you to uncover and archive your family's narrative. I started this project without any idea of what I'd discover, learn, or the consequences. And I'm pleased to report that while it's been intense and all-in experience, uncovering the chronicle of cannabis prohibition and my parents' and friends' historic secrets has been overwhelmingly positive, especially for the pot smugglers who buried their biographies for so many years. The truth will set you free. When we humans hold on to secrets and emotions, they become a heavy load. And revealing, communicating, and storytelling releases one from the power secrets and emotions have over us. Stories inform us and remind us who we are. I am a smuggler's daughter. I am the child of psychedelic counterculture outlaw artists, storytellers. And podcasts are the modern-day campfire. And since songs are part of the traditional campfire, I felt sharing my latest song would be a cozy way to end this chapter of disorganized crime, Smuggler's Daughter. I've told my story to the world. Who knows who will be next? Thanks for listening. Campfire style. Campfire style. Live, no fancy tricks. I'm a smuggler's daughter, water sign. My heart's a rainbow valentine. Raised amidst disorganized crime. The time has come for the stories of pot smuggler glories and downfall as calling all you hippie kids, calling all you counterculture misfits. The world wants the word from our buses, yurts, and teepees. Well, the word's the same sung in the 60s. Peace, peace, love. Daughter.
sing of other things like shoestrings and string cheese and cheesecake with key lime. The time has come for the stories of pot smuggler glories and downfalls. Calling all you hippie kids. Calling all you counterculture misfits. The world wants the word from our communes and cob houses. Well, the word's the same sung in the 60s. And mind chronicles of humankind. The time has come for the stories of pot smuggler glories and downfalls. Calling all you hippie kids. Calling all you counterculture misfits. The world wants the word from our hands made off the grid cribs. Well, the word's the same sung in the 60s. Sing along.
Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter is written and recorded by me, Rainbow Valentine. Our producers are Gabby Watts and Taylor Church. Executive producers are Brandon Barr, Brian Lavin, Elsie Crowley, and me at School of Humans, and Connell Byrne and Charles Bryant at iHeartRadio. Our music is by Gabby Lala and Claire Campbell, with original theme by Mark Caron and me. You can follow us online at disorganizedcrimepodcast.com.
Writing our own story, doing as we please. Tamil pies, sleeping princess of the redwood trees. She helps us keep it real. A handshake seals the deal. Grab the stash, seal a meal, and load up these old wheels. Rolling a doobie, young, rich, and groovy. Making it up as we roll along.